Hey friends, Andrew and I are excited to jump into another book study with you all. We're going to be jumping into a great book by New York Times bestselling author Eric Metaxas called If You Can Keep It, which is an incredible analysis of what makes the American experiment in liberty so unique, and what we need to do as citizens, self-governed citizens, to make sure that this constitutional republic of ours stays strong and continues to thrive for generations to come. You are not going to want to miss this podcast, and you're not going to want to miss this next series as we dive into these important topics.
Hey, welcome to the Ron Johnson Discipleship Podcast.
We're so excited you're with us today, and we're going to be kicking off a brand new book. You know, we decided in our podcast here that we enjoy using books as a launch pad, and we hope you enjoyed where we've come from thus far. A lot of you, when I see you, you're like, Pastor, I got that book, and I'm following along. And and then we use this time in our podcast to kind of launch off and get into a deeper dive. And, you know, we're just coming off the 4th of July, our nation's birthday. We just came off of a Freedom Sunday at Living Stones where we preach on these things. And we're getting ready to introduce, I guess, an author who is becoming one of my favorite authors, and that is Eric Metaxas. Of course, he's a New York Times bestselling author. I first got introduced to Eric on his book Bonhoeffer, which, of course, is the biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And this was a number of years ago when that came out. But what really hit me was the parallels between the church and Nazi Germany and the rise of Hitler, and the kind of the apathetic, withdrawn church in America that we saw in the last few years, especially that was made manifest during the COVID epidemic.
Right.
So that's how I got introduced to Eric Metaxas. But this is a short book, about seven chapters. And so if you'd like to get this, it's called If You Can Keep It, The Forgotten Promise of American Liberty, by Eric Metaxas. I got to let you all see it here. But it is a great, great book. And he's really dealing with the idea of American liberty, the foundation of this country, and the art of what it means to be free. And Metaxas says something that I think you and I can certainly agree with. He says we almost need to go back and get a primer and a reintroduction, an overview, the cliff notes on what it means to have a republic, you know, and to keep a republic and to live as free people as our founders, you know, conceived, and how radical this idea was in the first place.
Yeah, excuse me. I enjoy Eric Metaxas, especially the book Bonhoeffer. I also read it. I think I was reading it to study it for some sermon, but it introduced another picture of what a godly Christian man looks like than the most examples we typically learn. I mean, even you have the title here, Bonhoeffer, Pastor, Martyr, Prophet, Spy. Yeah, it's a very dynamic version of a godly Christian man who loves his nation, loves God, and wants to live his life for the kingdom of God, right? Yeah. And as I'm reading this book, If You Can Keep It, it brings up that similar theme of this, like, this idea of a Christian godly man is not maybe what we always have been imagining it to be, you know? There's a little bit more edge. There's a little bit more King David. There's a little bit more of the Apostle Paul in it than we expect. And that's really the theme behind, I think, this book is If You Can Keep It. There is a proactiveness of what does it mean to be someone who loves your nation and loves God. And that stirs up something in my own heart. It's like, oh, that, it really hits the spot.
Absolutely. Well, I like it. You don't usually find pastor and spy in the same sentence, you know.
Right.
But
prophet, spy, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But he brings out the point, too. You don't find America in the same sentence as the rest of the world either. Yep. There is something unique about American, what we call American exceptionalism. That's not like we're wonderful and we're better than the rest of you. But he gives the metaphor, a powerful picture of a field of daisies. And all of a sudden, right in the middle of this field of daisies is this gigantic sunflower. And that gigantic sunflower that's sticking out from the rest of the daisies represents America and the American form of government, which I think today, and we talked a little bit about this in the Freedom Sunday message, Americans today don't really understand the exceptional nature of the uniqueness of who we are as a people as it relates to the government that was shaped by our founding fathers. I mean, that idea of freedom was unheard of anywhere on planet Earth. And so we almost have to go back and say, wait a minute, you know, what? Why is it so unique? Because we literally take it for granted. And I say we, and I'm thinking of my kids and my grandkids. This is all that they've ever known. But the world has never known anything like America. And that's the thing that we need to recover, you know, as a people.
Well, I think one interesting thing he's mentioned in his book is that one of the reasons why we have taken it for granted is because after the American experiment has produced incredible results, many other world nations start to emulate America.
Right.
To the point right now, it seems like, oh, the kind of democratic republic, it seems kind of more normalized.
Right.
But the truth is, when they first got together in Philadelphia and tried to, you know, come together with the Constitution, what we have, the summation, what ended up being the Republic, is so unheard of and so experimental. And no one, and everyone in the world is looking at this crazy test tube experiment in America, thinking, yeah, are they going to make it, or are they going to, you know, destroy themselves? What the heck is going to happen to them, right?
Well, and we talked about the history of governments is a history of really the usurpation of power, or the collectivization of power. Yeah. And so the most common form of government throughout human history has been like a monarchy with kings or queens. Yeah. And we talked about that, finding that balance between anarchy, which is freedom without any restraint, and tyranny, which is, you know, way too much power in one place, where your liberties are trampled. And so how do you find the balance between, hey, we don't need any government, we're free to do whatever we want to do, which as we... Which
always leads to tyranny.
It always leads to tyranny, because yeah, licentiousness is just a lawless, personal lawlessness. Right. It leads to a societal lawlessness, and eventually somebody comes in and says, all right, I'm going to bring order to all this. And so, as you mentioned, it's either like a military coup or a military leader like Napoleon, or you just have the concentration of power in a king. And so or a concentration of the power in the Pope. And we've seen where whether it's in the church or in the state, the history shows that a concentration of power always leads to tyranny. And when it's the church and state working hand in glove, it's the worst. And that's right, what we've seen throughout history as well. And so he asked the question, you know, how do we keep this promise that was started, this promise of freedom, this promise of liberty? And he makes a good statement. He says, we cannot pretend that it is sufficient for us to mind our own business. Talk a little bit about that, you know. Why is it that, you know, kind of the idea of, hey, let's just be good Americans, obey the law, and everybody stay in your lane?
Right.
Why does that not really work? Because that's kind of where people are today. Like, you know, politics is kind of dirty, especially for the church. We don't really want to go there. And so let's just, you know, obey our authorities, go to church.
And you and I talked about this. You know, when I heard that statement from the book, it kind of shook me a little bit, because that's commonly taught in probably most churches. It's like, mind your own business, obey the law. You know, be a good citizen means you obey the law, you're a nice person, you kind of help your neighbors.
Right, right.
But he's saying, if everyone does that, we will lose our republic. And that shook me, because what he's saying is that the nature of the Republic of the United States is based on the foundation that we don't do that. There's a civil engagement way beyond mind your own business and just obey the law. There's a deeper sense of engagement that has to be normalized to every person, every citizen, or we're going to lose the essence of our nation. You know?
Because if it's a government of we the people, and we the people are not focused on government, at least by and large, like 90% or more, you know, just go to work every day and not really
follow
pay
whatever the news tells you. Hey.
Yeah, whatever they're doing in Washington, whatever. If the average citizen does not have a much higher IQ as it relates to government, and then a much greater involvement and engagement, then what he's saying is this government won't be sustained. It's going to collapse. And just, you know, it's an interesting title of this book. Some of you might know where the title came from. We're going to talk about that right now. But if you can keep it, where'd that phrase come from? Well, it's an interesting story. There was a Dr. James McHenry, who was a delegate from Maryland there at the Constitutional Convention in 1787. He was the youngest, or one of the youngest men in the convention at the age of 34. And he, in his journal, wrote about this historic exchange that took place that he was a witness to. And if it hadn't been, if he hadn't taken the time to go back and write it down, we wouldn't know about this great exchange. But evidently, Benjamin Franklin, who was the sage of the Constitution, he was in his 80s. He emerged from the building, and a certain woman by the name of Mrs. Powell of Philadelphia went up to him, and she asked him a question. And that question was simply, she said, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" And Franklin shot back, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." And so again, that idea of a constitutional republic, again, was something new on the scene of human history. Again, we're basically people elect representatives who represent them.
And under the rule of law, the Constitution. But I thought it was interesting because if you think about what Ben Franklin was saying at the time is, we understand that this is experiment and this thing we're putting into place is precarious.
Yes, very fragile.
Very fragile. Even from the very beginning, at the onset, you're saying, we're doing this, but it's really up to you and the next generation whether you can keep this experiment going. Yeah.
So. And the fragility of the idea lies in the fact that, you know, most nations at that time, like if you were a Frenchman, you found your identity as a nation through your ethnicity. So you identified as the Spaniards, the French, the Germans. But America from the beginning was a melting pot. Yeah. So we had no ethnic or racial or any other kind of normal boundary. There was no dictator that said, well, you're a whatever and I'm in charge. You know, we weren't held together by decree or by tyrant. We were held together by an idea. And ideas, like, you can't see ideas. Ideas are kind of vague. They're kind of like, what is the idea again? You know, I mean, you have to be reminded of these things, as you said, because it's almost like a vapor. Like, what is America again? Who are we again? And that idea was this idea of freedom, that we are free people. And that's really what drew everybody to the shores of this nation in the first place, was the idea that we wanted a place where people could live free before the Lord and live as free people with the gifts that God has given to us.
The Constitution, basically. So when people often say, what does it mean to be American? It's like, well, it can't be whatever you say it is, because if it's whatever you say it is, then it has no meaning. It's based on whatever different people's opinion is. It's not based on your opinion. It's not based on your worldview. It's not based on your religion. It's not based on, you know, your upbringing or whatever thing you want to bring from your heritage. It can't be that way because everyone will bring something different. Right. It has no meaning. Right. What does it mean to be American? For me, it's based, go back to the Constitution. When people say, well, you know, oh no, I'm proud of being American or I hate being American. What are you talking about? Yeah. To me, it goes back to the Constitution. You know, so there is it should be an implicit agreement when someone says, I want to become a citizen of the United States, to say, you know, I'm conforming myself to the Constitution. There should be. Of course, right now, no one knows the Constitution. No one reads the Constitution.
Right. And I guess if you distill the essence of the Constitution was really in document form an enshrinement of this notion of freedom and liberty.
Yeah,
that's what makes us unique. It's liberty. It's freedom. But then the founders had to deal with, okay, well, what does freedom mean, you know?
Right.
How is this expressed? And so he brings out, even before we get into that, that America from its inception was founded as a nation for others. He said, we're a nation with a mission beyond ourselves and beyond our borders, and we are a nation with a mission to the rest of the world. And of course, you know, he mentions the Statue of Liberty. And, you know, on that Statue of Liberty is enshrined these words, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. So even on this probably most iconic of all, you know, American statues or symbols, she's facing the harbor where immigrants come in. She's got a torch in the air. And it's basically saying, we are a place where you can come and breathe the air of freedom. What a powerful picture. He talks about John Winthrop's powerful image of a city on a hill shining for the world to see. And he says, you know, unless you're just a cynic, you know, it views America as always doing, helping out the rest of the world or freeing people. You know, like when we were in Kuwait, you know, well, that was all about American oil. That wasn't about freeing people or whatever. And, you know, so you get these American cynics, but you cannot deny that we have been used as a nation to be a blessing to the peoples of the world. We have liberated the peoples of the world. We have been in some ways a super cop for the people of the world, where there have been injustice and bloodshed, where we've come in and we don't come in and put, now this is now a part of the United States of America. We come in and liberate, and then we help rebuild the country and help people. This is unheard of as nations go. And he really says that from our inception, talking about Metaxas, from our inception, we've had a commitment and a vision that the freedom that we've enjoyed was not just for us to enjoy, that this was good news for the rest of the world that was living again under the bondage of bad government or tyranny. And so I thought that was a really, really good.
And one of the greatest things we export is that it's, first of all, the system of government of, you know, we're going to talk about self-government and kind of under God and constitutional government works.
Yeah.
At least prosperity, at least innovation. I mean, in the previous book, we talk about all the great innovation that came out of a government that allows people to be free and allow people to innovate and create, you know?
Well, it talked about free markets, you know, the ability to freely exchange goods, the ability to create, and then the government coming in doing its part to make sure that it protects your property, including your ideas and your inventions, you know, I mean, things like that, that creates an environment where people are incentivized to dream and take risk and do all the things that they do. But back again to this idea, he says our exceptionalist was not just for us, but it's for other people. And if we have been great, we have been good. And then he connects it together with a point that I've heard, you know, from the mission field over and over again, that if America ceases to be who America is, and if our freedom, if we cannot keep it, to go back to the title of this book, if we cannot keep America, the entire world suffers, because there is no place like America. Right. And I think that's what's been lost for many, many Americans is when America goes down, there will be a massive ripple effect as it relates to the freedom of other nations. Because knowing that that we are watching and the clout that we've had as a nation when we do business with other nations or we provide economic support for other nations, many times when we've had righteous leadership, not like now, but when we've had righteous leadership, that support was tied to civil rights and to human rights and to making sure that Christians were not being persecuted in that country. And, you know, there were certain strings attached to that money. And people knew, hey, we need to behave and treat our people well if we want support or help from the United States. So there was a sense of clout, I guess, that came along with our commitment to bless the nations of the world. And so he talks about the forgotten miracle of self-government. Precisely, he asks, how could the people govern? He said, after all, when in the history of the modern world had anyone ever entrusted his government to its people? Like, that idea right there is radical, just like to pause. Self-government, government by the people. Where on the planet did that ever exist?
It's a crazy novel idea.
Yeah.
I mean, again, back all those years ago, for them to come up with the idea, looking from the perspective, without taking what we have for granted, it's like, wow, you guys will actually do that? Because, you know, 99.9% of all the elites, and they would be considered the elites.
Oh, yeah.
Washington, Franklin, Jefferson, those guys, they would be saying, you know what? We know better, and we're going to keep the power in our hands. That's the history of the world.
And let's just put this in perspective, too. That gathering of people that shaped the American Constitution were some of the most gifted thinkers and most amazing human beings to ever grace the planet. I mean, these people were incredible. The amount of brain power and virtue in that one room is crazy. So you're exactly right. They could have easily said, hey, you know, guys, you're not really all that bright. It's kind of the elitist mentality you alluded to. We'll run government for. We'll run the planet. Leave it up to us.
If they did that, guess what? No one would. Thank you. No one would blink an eye. I mean, it's like the lady even there was like, "What did you guys give us? A republic or a monarchy?" Because people were probably expecting they're going to make George Washington king.
Well, and some did. I mean, his military leaders at one point wanted to make him king, and he rebuffed them.
Right.
And we'll get into that later. I think he deals with that. But that was the norm. You find the brightest, best, most powerful, and most kind dictator, and you put him in charge.
And people would have yielded to that naturally because that's all they knew.
Exactly. In fact, they were looking for that.
Right. So, look at the Israelites. Right.
Think about that. Oh, absolutely. Right. Think about how scared it would be for you and I as citizens if the government that we just came up with actually entrusted us to be the government.
Right.
I mean, no, it's scary both ways. Sometimes it's easier to just say, no, you lead. You're smarter than me.
Absolutely.
I don't know these laws.
I don't know these ordinances. I don't know what to make about this decision. Yeah, you guys make the call.
Hey, you're smarter than me. You've been off to school. I haven't been off to school. I'm just a farmer or whatever. And exactly. We're basically saying, no, this whole nation filled with many farmers, you guys are the government. and you're the government. And you're the government. Basically every citizen, you know. So that's pretty crazy.
It's incredibly crazy. It's incredibly a dangerous or risky move that I don't think we understand. We take for granted looking back now. We're just like, oh, of course, yeah, we the people. You know, it's just a phrase that people say now. We don't realize what a huge move they make and how that move, that dangerous, precarious move changed the history of the world.
Yes.
And I think we need to give its due celebration.
Oh, yeah. You know? Celebrate and then go, okay, well, we need a serious wake-up call.
But we need a wake-up call right now.
Because you got people today that are like, oh, I'm not even registered to vote. Well, why aren't you registered to vote? Well, you know, I don't want to be called for jury duty or, you know, I mean, yeah. I hear people say,
I don't know about any of these issues. Like, I don't read the politics. Yeah,
it doesn't matter who I vote for, you know. Right. In other words, this is the kind of behavior that's really dangerous because it's an abdication of your responsibility as a citizen.
We're going to lose our republic.
Yeah, like exactly.
Franklin said. Yeah.
We've got to deal with all of this. But he goes into the next part of the chapter talking about the necessity of government. So he says, you know, you can't just have raw freedom because freedom will devolve into licentiousness where everybody becomes selfish and just uses their freedom for whatever they want to do.
Mob rule and chaos.
Yeah, and then you end up having people that just dominate other people, whether it's on an individual level or on a national level. So you can't have that. He says, if mankind has always required the, quote, sword of government to keep certain troublemakers from destroying all order, just how was the founder's idea of freedom supposed to work? So in other words, if we're governed by everybody, who holds everybody accountable and how do we keep that kind of order? And he says, precisely how would their freedom be different from mere anarchy? And if such freedom could somehow be achieved within the context of government, how could it possibly be sustained? Wouldn't anything like real freedom be tremendously fragile and therefore short-lived? Great question. That's what we just alluded to. How do you maintain that type of freedom to keep it from imploding upon itself?
Yeah. We the people sound so pretty. But imagine going to your third grader class and say, guess what, guys? You guys are now in charge of the classroom. Yeah. We're going to give you freedom.
Yeah.
How's that going to turn out, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And you think even in American government today, you have that extreme, you know, anarchist kind of a group that's against every kind of order, every kind of authority. And basically what it results in is just mass chaos and burning down of buildings and you know, looting and
freedom,
violence.
Whatever you feel like.
Yeah,
right.
it's terrible. So it's like, okay, we don't want that. So our founders, again, asked what's the difference about American freedom, and we kind of touched on it. It has to do with ordered freedom. It doesn't mean freedom to do whatever you feel like you want to do. It is an ordered freedom where your God-given rights are protected by the government, but the government is also constrained because really the government is just us who have been elected to office. It's the same people who can be the anarchists, can be the same people who are the tyrants when they begin to take over. So how do you deal with that conundrum? How do you keep people from killing each other and from somebody dominating or allowing things to go to complete anarchy? And so the father, this is what's important. It is your worldview, and that's what we're talking about here. Our founding fathers were operating from a biblical Christian worldview, which gave them two critical insights into this whole idea of ordered liberty. The first insight was the fact that people are fallen. Every single human being has the propensity towards that kind of anarchy and wickedness and licentiousness, which is interesting because you could ask the question, yeah, just let everybody, you know, let everybody be their own government and let's all live happily ever after. Well, why is that not true? Well, it's because the Bible teaches us that there's this thing called fallen human nature, and that left to our own devices, we will become tyrants. We'll tyrannize other people, and we can't handle the freedom that we've been given because of our fallen human nature.
And I just want to contrast that to Marxism, which says the problem with socialism, the problem with our culture, society, is not the individual because we're born good. The problem is the society.
Right.
So this is a huge systematic issue. So this is a huge issue, a huge difference of the two different forms of government.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the idea, if you and I are basically selfish, then I have to protect you from me, and you have to protect me from you, and our government has to have checks and balances. Yep. And we can't concentrate power in one source. We've got to break it down into multiple sources. And so you see the genius of American government basically saying, okay, first of all, we have got to have smaller government. We've got to have branches of government. We've got to balance those powers of government. And there has to be checks and balances between them. None of this would be necessary if we lived in a perfect world and people were inherently good.
If you say people are inherently good and only problems with our systems, with the institutions— Then they would be architecting the perfect systems and let it running and don't worry about any check and balances because they have the perfect systems in place.
Yeah, and people will how
does that turn out for the rest of the world with socialism and Marxism? You create the perfect system because people are not the problem, right?
Yeah.
How does that work out for us?
We know that doesn't work out, yeah. And it's just not true. So again, but this is important. We talk about ideas have consequences on this podcast. That was an idea that led to amazing consequences because instead of being naive to self-government, we realized there's serious limitations to self-government, and these need to be considered and need to be built into the system. The other thing was not only are people fallen, but because of the truth of the gospel, people can be redeemed. That was the other balancing point that our founders understood, that you know what? Once Christ comes in, and this is why they emphasize the role of religion, and when we talk about religion, we're not talking about just dead, dry, you know, religion. We're talking about a dynamic relationship with Jesus that leads to a transformation of the human heart. Yes, we're fallen, but people who have encountered Christ, people who have experienced religion, are people who are then able, by the Holy Spirit and by the Word of God, to demonstrate virtue and to rule themselves. Mm-hmm. And so you've got, okay, we're going to set up a government that's got a lot of checks and balances because we know we still have to deal with our fallen human nature, but we're also going to rely on something outside of government, namely religion and the church and the gospel, to provide the moral infrastructure so that people can govern themselves. In other words, you know, if Christ has conquered my heart, then I'm going to submit to him, and I'm going to want to please him, and I'm going to want to do what's right, and I'm going to believe what the Bible says, and I'm going to try to follow the scriptures, and I know that God is watching me, and I know there's accountability for me personally because there's a final judgment day that's coming, and I am going to live a righteous life, not because somebody in government or a dictator has a sword threatening me, but I'm going to live a virtuous life because that's what God expects of me. That is the height of self-government. So it says something very powerful about what's happening in America today. The farther we drift from Christ and the church and the scriptures, the less power we have to govern ourselves because we no longer are a virtuous people. We're a selfish, sinful, perverted people. And our government no longer holds itself accountable because it even takes virtue within government to say, you know what? I can't operate that way. You know, I can't talk about my enemy that way. I cannot fudge the rules. There cannot be two tiers of government. I got to play by the rules just like everybody else. That takes virtue to even recognize that there are rules you need to abide by. And so we see in our government today a lot of two-tiered justice, right? The law applies to you, but let's just talk about this last situation. We have the most high security, high tech, you know, building on planet Earth is the White House. Mm-hmm. And we're being told that we may never know who brought cocaine into the White House. Like, wait a minute. And so first of all, everybody knows that's a lie because there's cameras everywhere. There's accountability everywhere. There's systems in place because this is the most highly guarded place on the planet. This is where the leader of the free world, you know, does his business and lives. So again, it is a foul stench to suggest that somehow that no one's going to be held accountable for this, or the person who leaked the information from the Supreme Court. Like, we know there's only a small group of people who could be responsible
right.
for that.
Right.
So the issue is a lack of integrity, and it's a lack of justice, it's a lack of honesty, it's a lack of virtue, which means even if you're in power, it doesn't mean that necessarily you're going to act in a virtuous way, or that we can protect you. Protect us from you because of checks and balances. Because the checks and balances only work if each of the different branches actually holds the other accountable.
And I think the biggest argument that's been trying to be made about the removal of all remnant of religion in government advocated by the left is that you can really have self-government. You can have virtue without religion.
Right.
And that's the real debate, which, again, I'm still trying to find how you can do. You can pretend for maybe a short season, but there is no transcendent,
right.
solid basis for you to be virtuous or for you to practice restraint and all those different things without religion. You know, I heard the debate between Alan Dershowitz and Alan Keyes a long time ago.
Yeah.
And Dershowitz.
Who's a liberal.
Who was actually more conservative now because of how liberal the left has gotten. It was arguing for virtue without God. But look at what's happening to a nation without God over and over again. Now, trust me, there's also religious side that has, you know, that's a false religion that with a religious institution that it becomes lack of virtuous. So I'm not even talking about that. But how do you, without a sense of a righteous judge who's going to judge you after death, how are you going to develop virtue? I still don't understand that. I mean, that's just me.
And think about some of these words we're bantering around. They're actually meaningless apart from a standard.
Right.
So we use the word virtue. Well, what's virtue? I mean, virtue in a a pygmy tribe that's headhunters, virtue is whoever gets the most heads.
Right.
You know, or what's justice? What's righteousness?
Right.
You know, I mean,
righteousness is obeying whatever the king tells you to do.
There has to be a standard. There has to be a plumb line. And so the point is this. I mean, there are modern liberals or atheists that can argue, well, I'm virtuous without religion. But the point is this. Our founders understood, period, across the board. Even the most irreligious of the founders understood that if our nation was not a godly, religious nation, it could not be sustained, because they believed, without an exception, they believed that you could not have virtue without religion.
The system was built. You know, someone who built a car is like, this is the battery we put in there. Well, I want to put this other battery. Well, you can put this other battery. It's not going to work because we designed it with this battery.
Exactly.
The Constitution, the limited government, the check and balances in the United States is built with a sense of a religious self-restraint on limited government based on, you know, self-government that's based on a religious order. That's how we were constructed. Now you take that out and you want to make it all work, it's not going to work. You're going to see decay. You're going to see corruption. You're going to see elitists trying to be kings once again. It's predictable.
You can see why this, you know, so for instance, I put on my Facebook page a little interview I did with Senator Braun. And I had some people jump on my Facebook page who were the Democrats from some county. And they said, look at this. There's a U.S. senator at a church. And this is a violation of separation of church and state. You know, there should not be politicians at churches. And I'm thinking, what planet did you come from? The entire Constitutional Convention took place in a church. Most of the meetings took place, government meetings took place in churches.
And they prayed.
They prayed in churches. They went to church. They understood that the church needed to be central in the shaping of the character of the people, or there could be no self-government. So my point is, if there is an open hostility, as there has been in America for 50, 60, 70 years, basically against religion or any involvement of, quote, religion in politics, you know, it's not going to bode well for our republic. You will not be able to see America last for long with that kind of open hostility towards religion.
Simply, it's like, you know, right now, you and I both are very blessed to live in a community in which I can leave my garage door open pretty much all day long. Simple as that.
Yeah.
There are other communities you would not leave your garage door open all day long.
Okay? Right.
Why? How? What's the difference? That's the question. It's a simple question.
Yeah. What keeps people from walking in your garage and going, "Wow, I'd like to take that lawnmower and
or come in my house through my garage open door and harm my family? And why is it that I can leave my house and leave a garage door open and not even think about it?
Right.
Why is that? And there's other places in not just our nation, but in the world that you would never, ever do that. What caused that freedom, that liberty that I can lead? Simple as that. We can lead it.
It's not the number of police you have, because you can't have enough police in a place where there's lawlessness. So,
Because they know I have tons of, well, the gun thing doesn't hurt either, but it's not like they, there's, you know, because I have a military.
But the bottom line is the reason I don't go into your garage is because inside of me, I have a moral compass that says, you know what, that's not my garage.
And those things don't go on. That's normalized in our community enough that I feel enough freedom to just drive to the store with the garage door open. Where does that come from? Fundamentally, where does that come from? That is the essence of American liberty.
And I would argue in our, for instance, in our community, it's not a perfect community. Those don't exist. But it is a well-ordered community and a safe community. Yeah. And I would say that the reason is because we have many, many good churches, and we have many people who would call themselves followers of Christ and who are disciples of Christ and who have self-restraint and self-government on the inside. They're able to govern their own appetites and desires. Yep. And so when you have a whole neighborhood full of people that are basically like that, you have safety. Right. If you have a neighborhood where everybody's looking to rape, pillage, destroy, steal, kill, you know, no one can live there because you have people that are out of control.
Well, you live there with very, very small liberty. Everything's shut down. Everything's regulated. Before you go into any building, you got to check, you know.
Well, and I've seen nations like this. I mean, you go to certain nations and they've got every citizen lives behind a small prison. They have safety walls. They have glass on top of the wall, so if you try to climb over, you cut your hand or the barbed wire. Yeah. All the windows have bars on them. It's like every citizen is in jail.
Right.
Because that's what they have to do to be safe. So you're exactly right. And we walk around free, and we leave our windows open, our doors open, our cars unlocked.
Unless it's
going to
ring.
Yeah, unless
it's going to ring. No liberty for that, yeah.
But I think, again, to go back to Metaxas's first point here, we need a new primer on liberty. If we don't rehearse the why behind the freedoms that we have, and we just take everything for granted, eventually we will lose those liberties.
Right. So again, the propagation of these restraints, is the government going to do that? Is the government going to come and teach your kids and say, "Hey, guys, you guys shouldn't steal. You shouldn't do all these things."
Right.
Does the government have the moral authority or even the ability or even the mission to go and do that and the effectiveness to communicate that to the people? Or does it require a religious institution with a transcendent cause and a purpose to communicate that, right?
And we've seen this. It's the family and it's the church that are required to do those things.
And the scripture, the Bible,
with
a transcendent cause to say, hey, this is beyond some random bureaucrat's idea.
Right.
This is the transcendent cause.
And our founding fathers knew that the government can only do so much. In fact, government's limited even scripturally, you know, to certain responsibilities, that government's not the end all. And so we require the state to do their job, we require the church to do its job, and we require moms and dads and families to do their job. And when all three are within their spheres of authority, we win. And when we have a breakdown of any of those and one gets bigger than it's supposed to be, that's when we have problems. So it is a very fragile thing that we're enjoying here. I think, I don't know about you, but we're experiencing I'm seeing more now than ever the fragility of this American dream. And I guess I'm just burdened with probably why we're doing this podcast and why we're reading this book right now, but burdened with making sure that we do everything we can to preserve the liberty and freedom we've been given.
Just real quick, you know, I was talking to my dad, who's, you know, pushing towards 80 at this point. You know, he was born during the Civil War in China, so he was born in a lot of chaos, turmoil, fleeing from, you know, all the stuff, and eventually they fled to Taiwan and whatnot. Anyways. And I'm hearing some of these horrors from his childhood.
This was under Mao.
Yeah, so he was, you know, my grandparents were in the Republic China's army, and they were fighting against the communists, and they were losing, and it was terrible. It was terrible. He was born in a horrific environment, okay? And, you know, they fled to Taiwan, and they were very poor, whatever. Just all the stuff that happened. So he's writing his memoir telling us all this stuff. He's telling me all this stuff. And, on one hand, my dad's telling me these just really horrific things that happened, you know, And then on the other hand, I look at my son playing his, Switch.
Yeah.
And I'm like, in just a couple generations, there's such a huge divide in how my dad was raised, how I was raised, and how my son is raised.
Yeah.
And how do I make sure that my son, two generations, remember the lessons and the pain and the turmoil and don't take what the blessing he has for granted from his grandfather.
Wow.
In just two generations.
There's nothing the matter with the technology he has and the fact that he has the time and the leisure to enjoy it.
But man, do I need to make sure that he does not take
take it for granted.
Take this for granted. Now that's just two generations.
And think about the flip of that. You went from pain, turmoil, suffering, concentration camps, dictators to incredible freedom. Yeah. It only takes a generation to go right back to where we came from.
Absolutely.
And that's the sober
part of it. And this book is saying, hey guys, it's been several generations and we are forgetting and forgetting and forgetting. And who's holding the torch?
Yeah.
Who's saying, guys, let's remember how precious this is? That's the question.
That's a great question. So anyway, here's the book, If You Can Keep It, by Eric Metaxas. Encourage you to pick up a copy and follow along with us. We're going to go through chapter by chapter and pull out some of the major ideas and apply it to what's happening in America today. So thank you guys so much for tuning in. We'll look forward to seeing you next Thursday.